Moikka ja paljon tervetuloa Kosmopolitia-podcastiin. Tässä podcastissa käsitellään erinäisiä yhteiskunnallisia teemoja taivaan ja maan väliltä vieraiden kanssa, jotka ovat omien alojensa asiantuntijoita omalla alallaan. Mä oon Kärnen Juho, mä oon ensimmäisen vuoden politiikkatieteiden ja sosiologian opiskelija ja mun kanssa tätä podcastia juontaa
Kati Erme.
Näissä jaksoissa me tullaan käyttämään suomea tai englantia ja tämä ensimmäinen jakso tulee englanniksi. Tähän vielä lisäyksenä se, että tämä podcast on poliittisesti sitoutumaton ja sen tehtävä on avartaa kuulijoiden maailmankuvaa ja olla auttavana tekijänä esimerkiksi opiskeluissa ja antaa uutta perspektiiviä maailmaan.
Kosmospolitia. Okay, switching to English now. The topic of today will be international community, the war in Ukraine, and we will also talk a little bit about the state of world politics in the future.
So, our first guest is Professor of International Relations Julian Reed. Welcome, Julian.
Hi, thanks. It's great to be here.
Let's start with a little introduction. Could you tell us and our listeners, who are you, where are you from, and how did you end up this position in Rovaniemi and to study these subjects?
Great question. So I'm originally from the United Kingdom. I grew up mainly in Scotland, and then I studied in England. I did my bachelor's degree in London at a university called King's College London, and that was in war studies, actually. That was my original degree. That was my kind of like original interest, was in understanding war. And that was a program which looked at war from interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary perspectives, you know, mm-hmm. politics, philosophy, sociology, the full range of kind of possible perspectives. And and I graduated a long time ago now. It's like 1996. Wow, that's what was that, 28 years ago?
Yeah.
And then I moved to Amsterdam and took a master's degree there in international political economy, which is like a kind of niche area of international relations. And of course, international relations is the social science which is maybe most responsible for thinking about the issue of war, the phenomenon of war, the theory of war. So yeah, I kind of moved into IR that way, did a master's degree in Amsterdam, and then I went back. It was 1998, and I wanted to do a PhD to continue this and develop it as an academic career. So then I moved back to England to a small city in the north west of England called Lancaster, which is a small market town somewhere not too far from Manchester and Liverpool, with a really great a university and a big department of politics and international relations. And there I wrote my PhD, which was basically about the theory and philosophy of war, but especially taking ideas from Michel Foucault and other, at the time, very fashionable thinkers, but people didn't really know too much about their thinking on war. So my PhD, the way in which I set it up was like, this was going to be the first major work to really look at their thinking about war and then try to transfer that to international relations. So I did that and finished that in 2004. But by that time, I had already started teaching. So I got my first teaching job in 2002, and that was back in London, in a place called SOAS, which is one of the colleges of the University of London. It's like, its full name is the School of Oriental and African Studies. Yeah. And it's like, it's world famous for thinking and research and teaching about, especially issues connected with colonialism and imperialism. In fact, its original purpose was really to provide knowledge to the British Empire how to do colonialism. That was its original that was its original rationale.
Of course.
Yeah, anthropologists and political scientists and historians all trying to enable the British Empire. Over time, it had changed and become a much more critical kind of place to do research and study. But that was just a temporary job. It was like 2 years. And then I got my first permanent lectureship down in the south coast of England, a small city called Brighton, where the University of Sussex is based. And they had a really good politics and IR department. And I went there, started teaching there. But then I decided to apply back. I was kind of missing London. I had enjoyed being in London as a student and teaching there, and I wanted to go back. So I got a job back in King's College, where I had originally started my studies. Went back there in and six and started teaching there. And by this time, I had met a Finnish girl. It's probably a very common story. Okay. And we thought it would be a great idea to come to Finland and experience life in Finland. I'd been to Finland a few times. I liked it. It was interested in spending more time there. And 2007, University of Lapland needed a temporary professor, but in Finland, when they can't find somebody good enough to appoint as full professor, what they do is they appoint somebody on a temporary basis. Mm. So there's a 2-year position in Finland open to be the professor for 2 years. And to be honest, I didn't really understand that Lapland is a real place. For me, it was like a mythic or fictional place.
Reindeers and stuff.
Yeah. And I definitely never heard of the University of Lapland. Anyway, it worked out. And so suddenly I was coming to Finland for 2 years, and to Rovaniemi, and to Lapland, and I had no idea what to expect. But anyway, it was only 2 years of my life, so it was a big adventure. But when I came here, I kind of fell in love with the place. You know, not just Finland, but Rovaniemi and wider Lapland. I found that I really enjoyed living here and also teaching here. The university, you know, it's small, but it's also very supportive and friendly, and I like the fact also that suddenly I was teaching in a university where students don't pay fees. That was a big plus for me, because I was used to this UK system, which is very economy-driven, market-driven. Students pay ridiculous amounts of money for their education. So for me, it was a totally different culture in a very positive way. And by the end of those 2 years, I didn't really want to go back to England. I was very happy, very settled. I had to go back. I went back, but then a permanent professorship opened up, and so I applied for that, and I was really fortunate to get that. And that began in 2010. So I moved back full time to Finland, and I've been here.
And now you're here.
And now I'm here. Yeah.
And you like it?
I love it. I mean, Finland has changed a lot, and also the university system has changed a lot in these 17 years. You know, we see the role of the market and the economy more and more, putting pressure on universities to change the way in which they operate. But it's still, at this point in time, for me, it's still a better model than the British model, which really, you know, became so driven by money.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for the introduction.
Yeah. So moving on to the actual topic of today, as Europe is now closer to war since the Cold War, with NATO expanding and also the war in Ukraine still unresolved, there has also been conversations on preparing for the war expanding to rest of Europe and even sending Western troops to Ukraine. So our first question would be, what are the possibilities and steps to achieve actual peace in Europe?
Yeah, great question. I mean, we're already at war, right? So, you know, peace, if it really even ever existed, because, you know, you look at the history of Europe and you can see that war has been a continual pattern to some extent. But, of course, we're talking about a different situation today here in 2024 since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The threat to the rest of Europe is much more real, and we are already involved in trying to help the Ukrainians to win or at least not lose their war against the Russian invasion. So, you know, it's important to recognize that we're already mobilized, and hybrid war, you know, is also a reality.
Yeah.
You know, every day it's being fought in different spaces of society and so forth. But, I mean, in terms of the future potential for at least interstate peace in Europe, maintenance of the peace. And let's remember also that, you know, since 1945 and the horrors of the Second World War, you know, the sustained relative peace in Europe, it's quite impressive. It's very impressive, actually.
Yeah.
70 years or so of continuous peace, probably the longest peace in Europe since at least the 19th century, when you had this long gap between the Napoleonic Wars, which ended in 1815, and then the horrific First World War, which broke out in 1914. Yeah, I mean, I think it's obvious, isn't it, that if we are to maintain peace and to increase peace, then we have to defeat Russia. We have to defeat Putin's regime. At the very least, prevent them from winning in Ukraine. That's absolutely crucial. If Putin were able to claim victory in Ukraine, then, you know, what's the next step? There's certainly no security or peace in that context of a Russian victory. So beating Russia preventing them at the very least from from winning is absolutely crucial.
So you think that the Russian government has to be changed, or at least to beat Russians in the Ukraine to achieve the peace?
I mean, it would be great. It would be so wonderful to be able to change the regime in Moscow and to imagine a more democratic future for Russia. That would be, you know, the ultimate in a way.
Yeah.
The ultimate key to wider peace in Europe would be to change our relationship with Russia, and to do that really requires a complete change of regime, a more democratic regime, people that we can deal with and trust. You know, the trust is broken between Russia and Europe, and it's going to be it's very difficult to see how it can be rebuilt, especially when we look at social patterns in Russia. You know, the reality is that Russians, not all of them, but many of them, support this war. They see it as necessary. They see it as a war of defense, and they're and in terms of foreign policy, they support Putin. They might disagree with his policies and his success in terms of the economy and wider politics in Russia, but most of them think that this war is a defensive necessity for Russia vis-a-vis NATO. So I think hoping for a different Russia, a more democratic Russia, it's a nice thing to hope for, but is it realistic? I don't know. Not at least in the short term. It may happen over time, and we should, of course, definitely be working for that over time. In the short term, though, I think we have to beat Russia in Ukraine. We have to give Ukrainians as much support as we possibly can to ensure that Russia don't succeed in Ukraine, and also continue to be alive and responsive to the execution of hybrid war in the rest of Europe.
Yeah, and this is a really big question, because if we have an answer to this, I think we all would have a Peace Nobel Prize or something. Okay, so thank you for that. The next question would be, President Macron of France have teased about sending Western troops to Ukraine. What do you think about that? What are your thoughts? And what are the consequences? Is it the World War III, or what is it?
I mean, I think what Macron said was that we shouldn't rule it out. Right? We shouldn't rule out sending troops, which is completely correct. You know, it would be stupid to rule. Once you rule out the possibility of sending ground troops, you're basically saying, okay, we're willing to bargain with you.
That's true.
Right? So it's important to recognize that fact. The reality is that deployment of ground troops is something which is unlikely to actually happen. Something would have to change to make it possible, not least because, you know, the majority of French citizens wouldn't support it. Macron would lose power pretty quickly if he was to mobilize. He'd have immense difficulty convincing the rest of the government to agree to such a policy. And, you know, Germany at the moment is just no appetite for a mobilization of European ground troops in Ukraine. So it would be something which would be really hard to achieve. It would also be a huge risk in terms of it being an escalation of the war, and you have to ask, well, how is this going to provoke? How will this change the strategy of the Russians and Putin? Would they try to move or expand the theater? Would they see NATO countries and peoples as fair game in the context of a direct conflict of European militaries with Russia? It would change so many things. So it's something which would take a lot of thinking through, and you'd have to make sure that you had the political support to do it. I think realistically, the more sensible policy at the present is to increase our support for Ukraine, which has done an incredible job so far over these past 2 years in fighting off the Russian invasion. And Ukraine can still do more in terms of mobilizing its own people, so there should be no necessity actually to send our own ground troops. And I think when we look at the relationship of the support which Europe is providing to Ukraine and its participation in the war, you know, we have to ask, why aren't we doing more in terms of providing armaments and funding to support the Ukrainians in going back on the offensive and defeating Russia? I think there's so much more to be done there in terms of increasing the level of support. Also just in terms of increasing our own readiness, our own preparedness. I mean, if you look at defense spending across Europe, it's pretty minuscule.
Yeah.
In relative terms, you know, every European country is different, but and there are differences from west to east. But you've got cases like Spain, for example. You know, what do they spend on defense? I don't know, 1% of their GDP. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, what is 1% of an economy? You know, compare it with an ordinary middle class person. If you were to say, hey, I want you to spend an extra 1% of your income on something, it'd be like asking somebody to, hey, you know, do you fancy a Netflix subscription?
Yeah.
Or yes or no? You know,
yeah.
You know, no big deal. So that's we should be doing way more.
Yeah, and as well, the actual like modern warfare armament is so like efficient nowadays. Like with the drones and everything, it makes like possible to attack like cities really far away. So that's a whole like new area that probably hasn't been
absolutely
explored.
And that's a really good point. That's something which we've really seen and learnt about from this experience of Ukraine defending itself against the Russians, is the extent to which war today requires not just the mobilization of the armed forces, but the extent to which societies themselves can participate and contribute to the war effort. So Ukraine's relative success in not getting beaten, not rolling over, has depended very much on the mobilization of Ukrainian society to use drones, for example, which anybody can do.
Yeah. And like the drones and all that, like that's the modern stuff, but it's been pretty like horrifying to see the war clips from Ukraine, that the warfare is pretty similar than to the World War II.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed too much.
It's very true, isn't it? It's a blast from the past in many ways, this war.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Okay, we will go to the third question.
So this year there has been a lot of changes and will be a lot of changes in world politics, such as elections in Russia and the USA. So how would these elections, especially the elections in the US, affect the support given to Ukraine? Will the role of EU possibly grow?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone anticipates that were Trump to win, then the US would withdraw more than it already has in world affairs. I mean, this is part of his platform, right? Is get, you know, withdraw support, cut the relations of dependence of the United States with Europe, become more insular, give more attention to American well-being, understood in very narrow nationalistic term. So I think we have to anticipate, should Trump win, then it's going to mean cutting those that support which does exist. But when we actually look at what America is spending in Ukraine, the extent of support, it's also pathetic. You know, I mean, we assume that in Washington they really care, but I'm not sure they do care that much about the outcome. In Ukraine, if they did, they would be much more involved. They would be spending much more. They would have they would have people on the ground observing. It's incredible that the U.S. doesn't even have anybody on the ground observing the war, learning from what's going on, in order to better support the strategy. So I think we have to look at it in context of the fact that, you know, America is already withdrawn from world affairs compared with previous historical eras. You know, the America of the Cold War, the America that saw itself as the world's policeman and which other states and societies looked to for protection and leadership, that's already gone pretty much. It doesn't really exist anymore. And there's no sign that it's really going to come back. You know, if Biden wins the election, in other words, the Biden administration currently shows, you know, very limited interest, actually. Has to say the right things, and I'm sure that they do want to support Ukraine, but the actual materiality of the support is very limited. I think Biden is much more interested, actually, in the Middle East. You know, he's very pro-Israeli, and their attention to that conflict is, I think they care more about the outcome of Israel v. Hamas than they do Ukraine v. Russia. I think they could probably afford for Russia to win in Ukraine. Which is scary, you know. So their perspective, it's different from ours here in Europe, and we should be awake to that. So in other words, you know, whoever wins this year in the United States, it's not going to solve our problems in Europe. It's not going to solve the war in Ukraine. From our perspective, it's not going to help us. We have to prepare for a world in which the United States is withdrawing politically and strategically, regardless of the outcome of the election, also is in a major economic decline, right? So the fact is that US is in economic decline. It's not going to be the power that it has been economically, certainly in the future. China is on the rise and will gradually assume, will have the power anyway, to assume the kind of global leadership which the US has had historically. So we in Europe, you know, we are also in decline, of course. Our power relative to other states and other areas of the world is in decline. We have to learn to take care of our own affairs. That's the only future I can see for us, is the ability to outgrow our dependence on the United States. And on, which also means on NATO, right?
So, yeah.
Which is really interesting context of what's been happening here in Finland over the last couple of years. Obviously, Finland's now a member of NATO, and there are good reasons for that, and it makes sense from a variety of different perspectives. But in terms of thinking about the long game and the long term, I think we have to plan. Every European state the EU itself and Europe itself has to plan for a world in which it can be self-sufficient. And able to defend itself from the major sources of threat. That means increasing our defense spending, definitely, and being able to wage war against Russia, independent of both the US and NATO. We need different arrangements, new ways of preparing for the future, such that if Trump is elected, we shouldn't have to worry about it. You know, we shouldn't be dependent on American support. Because that is an unreliable ally in every respect, whether it's Trump or Biden. We can't depend on either administration in Washington to defend us.
Elaborating a little bit on the role of the U.S., because as Orban and Trump met here some time ago, Orban talked about Trump's idea for the peace in Ukraine, and that the idea concludes that USLA will end the arms aid for Ukraine. And as you talked about earlier, I was thinking, like, why is it that the USA is kind of taking a step back? What are the reasons for that?
Good question. I mean, we've always had this kind of flip-flop in American foreign policy in terms of the differences which it makes whether or not a Republican is in power in the White House or whether it's a Democrat. And if we look back historically, you can see that actually it's the Democrats which have been more outgoing, more willing to use America's immense military capacities to intervene and defend other people's, because Democrats tend to see other people's well-being as more related to American national security interests, whereas Republicans have always been much, much more skeptical about the scope of the American national interest and what and where it makes sense to use American military power. So the classic example of that is, of course, the Vietnam War, right? So, you know, the Vietnam War gradually draws the United States in the 1950s. But in the 1950s, you had a Republican in the White House. You had Dwight Eisenhower and his right-hand man, John Foster Dulles, who was, you know, he was ideologically completely opposed to the Soviet Union and to therefore also the People's Republic of China, to communism. You know, that was his bread and butter, was fighting against communism. But at the same time, they didn't really want to get drawn into a war far away in Vietnam. It's only in the 1960s, when the Republicans lose power and you have the election of Kennedy in 61, that you see America escalating its presence and its war in Vietnam. And then, of course, Kennedy gets shot. He gets replaced by Lyndon Johnson. And Johnson's policy interests were actually domestic. He was interested in trying to solve poverty. But he, too, got majorly drawn into Vietnam, and that's the period when you see the escalation of war and American troops en masse being sent to fight war and die in Vietnam. And similar observations can be made about every other period of American history. So there's always been that kind of flip-flop in terms of the relative willingness of the United States to get involved in defending people different from themselves. Mm. And Trump is, so in that sense, Trump is a classic kind of Republican. I mean, we know that in many ways he's different. He's a peculiar kind of figure in the history of American politics. But he's also classically Republican, I would say, in foreign policy terms, but maybe much more radical in terms of, you know, just saying outright, bluntly, that this we would cut support for the war in Ukraine. I think actually he says somewhere that he's interested in giving Ukraine loans. So
yeah,
so, you know, he's also a businessman, right? So he's thinking out, he's thinking about it as a money-making opportunity. Like,
yeah.
Let's indebt Kiev to us in order so that they can wage war against the Russians. So it's a strange thing. But yeah, the longer term trend is, of course, to American economic decline. America has less and less capacity, actually, to do stuff internationally and to wage war, unless it happens to be clearly in its own interests, militarily and economically and politically. And then we, you know, when Trump, when it comes to the question of the relationship of America to Europe, we can, you know, Trump is really in your face saying that we owe you nothing. You just take, and you have to, and you have to take care of your own affairs because we're not willing to do it for you in the future. And I think, you know, realistically, we should listen to that and take it on board and just say, okay, we're going to do exactly that. You know what? We don't need you. Because the truth is America is that Europe could do it by itself. We don't need the United States.
That's where I'm with the side with Trump, because of the 2% of the NATO expenses to the defense, I think that's the minimum that every country in NATO should.
And some of us don't. Some European states just don't spend it anywhere near that. I think the further west you go, I mean, the UK is a bit of an exception because it has this state which is quite invested in its abilities to wage war and do defense. But, you know, look at Spain or Portugal. You know, they're not interested in what's happening even in Ukraine. It's not for them. It's not a problem. It's not a threat. Putin's not going to invade, or bomb Portugal or Spain. Here where we are, it's different game altogether.
That's true. How about the elections in USA? Who would you put your money on? Biden, Trump, or somebody else?
I think it's really difficult to call. Certainly, that's what the polls indicate. That it's, if it's Trump v. Biden, then it's very difficult to call. I think Biden, you know, it's for me, it's amazing that this guy manages to remain in power, let alone now campaign to be reelected. I mean, he's clearly challenged mentally, and, you know, it's a feature of age. I don't know how old is he, about 80 or whatever. You know,
something
he's
like that.
He's way gone. You know, mentally, he just doesn't look like he's there or able to lead a country. So there's some. There's clearly something wrong also with American democracy, that they have this choice between this demented, to put it impolitely, you know, somebody who's suffering from early onset or late onset dementia, versus Trump, this non-professional businessman who has very questionable qualities. I have to say that when you listen to Trump, you know, not everything he says is stupid. He's sometimes represented as being just stupid. I don't think that's quite right. And nor do I think the people who vote for him are necessarily stupid either. I think there was a legitimate context in 2016 when it was Clinton versus Trump. So, you know, the liberals in Washington had managed to alienate large sections of the American public, especially those white working classes that were disadvantaged by policies enacted domestically under Obama. So, you know, I think there are reasons why America is less and less willing to act.
Okay, we should move to a wider perspective here, and let's talk about United Nations a little bit. Our fourth question regarding that would be what would be the steps to make the international community more powerful, because we have seen that the UN is not capable of necessary actions to end humanitarian crisis. In example, Israel-Palestine conflict, what we are seeing right now. Is it through stronger legislation, or what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I'm really skeptical about the abilities of you know, the international community to use international law to solve humanitarian crises or to make to change anything really in international relations. I mean, my memory and experience was shaped very powerfully in 2003. That was when I had just started teaching by the war in Iraq, right? So you had this American intervention in Iraq, and people took to the streets in European capitals and all over the world, and practically every other state was opposed to it, and the United Nations tried to intervene and use international law or defend international law from what was a flagrant abuse of Iraqi sovereignty, but was powerless to do anything about it. Nobody could stop the Americans from doing what they wanted. So for me, you know, international law, it's a really weak mechanism for preventing the use of war. When a state as powerful as the United States is wants to use it, right? And you can see this likewise today here now in context of the Middle East and the Israeli waging of war in Gaza and against Hamas. So, you know, there's an attempt to create a ceasefire. United Nations tries to mobilize for a ceasefire. US just says, no, you know, we're not having that. We're not going to let that happen. We want Israel to continue to wage war in order to get the hostages back, in order to defeat Hamas. If the US wants something, it gets what it wants. And the international community is powerless to do anything about it. And, you know, you listen to the rhetoric, the discourse, the reasons which the Israelis give for doing what they're doing, and the reasons which the US likewise gives for supporting Israel, they also resort to international law, legalistic arguments to make their case. So I'm really skeptical about the capacity of the international community to intervene in the affairs of powerful states like the US and their closest allies.
Yeah, as a young person, the United Nations as a institution gives a hope because of the ideology behind that. But it's frustrating to see that they can't really do anything about anything, actually.
Yeah.
There is something they can do, and they can say things that is pretty good. They can open discussions. But it's just so like frustrating to see that they are not capable of anything.
That's right.
Realistically, to do anything.
Yeah, we still live in a world of states, and state power really matters, and the inequality between state power really is decisive in determining outcomes in international relations still today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, as we are talking a little bit about the Middle East, where there has been a lot of humanitarian crisis, as well as in other parts of the world. But overall, what ethical considerations should policymakers take into account when contemplating military interventions, particularly in conflicts involving humanitarian crisis or human rights abuses even?
I mean, of course, the sanctity of human life ought to be the guiding ethical concern of each and every state, or at least that's what we would wish for, right? And what's interesting is when we see how warfare takes place, military interventions take place, states wage war, you know, Israel against Hamas, for example, in Gaza, or the United States and its allies in Iraq in 2003 and beyond, we see how much ethics, in a sense, matters, because they have to be able to frame their war in a way that at least appeals to the ethical sensibilities and feelings of the wider world. They have to be able to package their war. They tried their very best to package their war in a way that makes it seem ethical. You know, the whole concept of humanitarianism and humanitarian intervention and even humanitarian war, right? This goes back to the 1990s. But since the 1990s, you know, it would be hard to find a case of a major war which has been fought, which has not been described as a humanitarian war. I think, you know, even Putin describes the war in Ukraine as it's a humanitarian, it's, you know, it's, I forget the euphemism which he uses, but he also talks about it in humanitarian terms. You know, they're there to save life, save the life of Russian-speaking minorities or whatever. So you can see that ethics always is always mobilized in support of war. But then we look at the reality, you know, the blatant disregard for the value of civilian life in Ukraine or in Gaza today, or in Iraq. You know, I forget now how many hundreds of thousands, I think, of ordinary Iraqis died as a consequence. You know, women and children died as a consequence of the American military invasion of Iraq in 2003, or how many Palestinians it is that are dying every single day because Israel is willing to sacrifice their lives in order to try to annihilate Hamas. So, yeah, I'm really, I would wish that we would live in a world where ethics really could shape the actual practices of warfare in a way that would protect civilians. But the reality is that it has this double function. It ends up legitimating warfare in many cases, giving people the belief that the war, the wrong belief, the illusion that the war they're doing is somehow ethical. When military killing, you know, it's very hard to make that ethical.
That's true. Okay, we are heading to the end of this episode. The last question would be, how do you see world politics situation in, let's say, 5 to 10 years? Is it going downhill, or do you see any sparks of hope?
Yeah, I mean, international relations, it's got a horrific record at predicting anything, at getting anything right in terms of thinking about the future. We have a hard enough job trying to make sense of what's happened in the past, as well as what the hell's going on today, let alone when it comes to the question of the future. So it's really tricky to make concrete predictions about outcomes and change. On the other hand, you know, change is the rule in international relations. The world we live in today is so dramatically different in many respects from the world 100 years ago, or even 30 years ago, that nobody knows what's going to happen. But there are megatrends. On the other hand, there are these megatrends. So I don't see a reverse in American decline. I think that's going to continue economically and strategically. I think we'll see the United States gradually withdrawing. And it's open to interpretation and decision as to how the rest of the world responds with that, to that new reality, how especially Europe deals with it. What I would hope for is that in this context of gradual economic and military and strategic decline of the US, that Europe will become more independent, more self-sufficient in terms of its abilities to defend itself and solve its own problems. That's what I would hope we will see happening gradually over the next 5 to 10 years. I would hope also that Ukraine continues to be successful in defending itself from Russian invasion, and ultimately I would love to see Putin defeated and more democratic things to hope for going on in Russia too. But those are open questions, and I'm not going to make any prediction as to how that will play out. Of course, the rise of China seems also to be irreversible, right? It's a reality. It's something which is difficult to imagine not continuing. Something major would have to happen in China for it not to continue. So I think we have to imagine and prepare for a world in which China is more and more economically powerful, and maybe also more and more interested in deploying its power globally in a way that maybe over time might compare with previous superpowers.
Yeah.
And finally, do you have any kind of readings, any books, articles, something like that you would like to recommend to anyone who's listening?
Sure. Yeah. So we were talking about like the failures of the international communities, the problems with it. International law, its inefficacy in terms of solving humanitarian crises. This is something which I wrote about in my first book. It's called The Biopolitics of the War on Terror. And there was also an article which I published in about 2004, 2005. And I wrote it during the war. And it's really a critique. It's kind of like a quite theoretical critique of the failures of international law and the failures of the international community to prevent the exercise of state imperial sovereignty, American sovereignty, in Iraq and the wider world. So I definitely mentioned that. And then there's also my second book, which is called The Liberal Way of War, which is really about the role of warfare in liberal states and societies, and the way, you know, in international relations, when we talk about liberalism, we always talk about it as a theory and an approach based upon the desire for peace and for making the world more peaceful. But then we look at the record of liberalism as a state, as a set of states, and as a ideology too. We see that, in Europe, for example, there has been increasing peace between states that used to be at war because of the development of liberal democracy. You know, it's incredible, the record of peace between the major powers in Europe, Germany, France, and the Brits as well. But on the other hand, we see this continuing willingness to wage war against other peoples outside of Europe. And so The Liberal Way of War, that was really about that. It's probably my most popular book, actually, still today. But after I came to Finland in 2010 on a permanent basis, back in those days, you know, Finland was a very different place, also in terms of foreign policy and in terms of international relations as a discipline and as a set of conversations. So in those days, Finland wasn't really interested in war, wasn't threatened by Russia, and there was much more interest in things like development policy, solving poverty, solving the climate crisis, you know, kind of soft issues. So then my research in that context, it shifted towards those kind of issues which were more interesting from this perspective. Mm. So I started writing about development, and resilience has been kind of my big theme for the last 10 years, the way in which this new concept and idea of resilience has replaced security, replaced the old idea of security in international relations. And that's something which I write about in two books. One is called Resilient Life, The Art of Living Dangerously, and the other one is called The Neoliberal Subjects, Resilience, Adaptation, and Vulnerability. I've also written a bit about indigenous politics in a book called Becoming Indigenous. And that was actually my last publication in book terms. Mm. But now today, of course, I'm going back to war because it's we need to think it through. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in the connections between war and resilience, what it means and what's involved in making states and societies like Finland more resilient to threats and catastrophes like potential invasion and so on and so forth, and how also NATO is thinking in terms of resilience, because it's a major concept for NATO. It's going to be in the future. You know, it's not just going to be about states using their armed forces to defend people from threats and invasions. It's going to be about mobilizing society. So what's happened in Ukraine in terms of the amazing resilience of the Ukrainians to Russian invasion, that's going to become a kind of blueprint and framework for the organization of warfare in the future, certainly within the realm of NATO. And there's a lot of interest, actually, in Finland, because Finnish people are seen to be incredibly resilient. So other NATO countries want to learn from Finland how to become resilient in order to be ready for things like Russian invasion.
Yeah, that's the Finnish issue, what we have.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's all we have. All the questions. We really want to thank you, Julian, for coming here. We respect that you visited us. Ja sitten me ollaan valmiita tässä jaksossa. Halutaan kiittää kaikkia kuuntelijoita. Ja lisää on luvassa. Thank you, Julian.
Kiitos paljon.